This is a CBC podcast.
Hi there, I'm David Cochrane, and this is the Power and Politics podcast for March 21st. Conservatives say Canadians would be better off without the carbon tax, but does the math add up? We'll crunch the numbers with the Parliamentary Budget Officer. Plus, the federal government moves to strip the military of the power to investigate sexual offences. We'll ask the Minister of National Defence why it took the government so long to make this change. And a senior Conservative advisor's lobbying firm is under scrutiny. Reporting shows her staff set up a second lobbying firm out of the same office right after Pierre Poilievre won the Conservative leadership. We'll talk to the Globe and Mail reporter that broke the story, and the Power Panel will discuss the optics. We're going to start today on Parliament Hill. This is a live look inside the House of Commons, where later this hour, MPs will vote on a non-confidence motion introduced by Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre. Now, the motion is meant to topple the government and trigger a federal election over the carbon tax. We're going to have live coverage of the vote when it happens in about 45 minutes and get reaction and analysis from the Power Panel. But first, as the political debate grows over the impact of the federal carbon tax, there's one report that is often quoted. The Parliamentary Budget Officer looked into how much it's actually costing Canadian households. And now, both the Liberals and the Conservatives are using his findings to their advantage.
The Parliamentary Budget Officer confirms that in every single province, Canadians pay far more in taxes than they get back in rebates.
Family of four in Nova Scotia gets about $824 back in the year for the price on pollution.
Well, the Parliamentary Budget Officer confirmed that the cost is $1,500 for the average Nova Scotia family. The
Parliamentary Budget Officer clearly spelled out that 8 out of 10 Canadian families in areas where the price on pollution applies get more money back every year than they pay in the price on pollution.
To better understand the original analysis, let's bring in Parliamentary Budget Officer Yves Giroux, who joins me now. Sir, it's good to see you again.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
So you, I'm sure, have been watching what's been happening in the House of Commons. The conclusions in your report, they're being cited by the Conservatives in particular as proof that Canadians are worse off because of carbon pricing, and that means this policy needs to go. Is that a fair representation of your findings?
Well, it's a representation of our findings once you also include the economic impacts of introducing a carbon tax. So there's the fiscal impact on households, paying the tax versus the amount of the rebate that households are receiving. But once you also include the economic impacts due to the introduction of a carbon tax, for example, the reduction in activity or the slower growth in economic activity in some sectors, then that's the impact.
Okay, so let's just go through that a bit by bit. Let's start with the fiscal analysis, the financial analysis. This is what the government points to. They say most families will still get more in rebates than they pay, and sort of straight cash out, straight cash in. Is that a fair representation?
That's a fair representation of our report. That's the conclusion we arrived at. If you take into consideration the carbon tax that households pay on their fossil fuels that they're buying, gasoline, natural gas, diesel, so they pay that directly, as well as the embedded energy component of whatever goods and services they buy, and they subtract from that the rebate, then about 80% of households are better off.
Okay, so this is, I want to go to that economic analysis, and this is where it gets complicated, and this is where it gets controversial, because you took a look at the broader effect that carbon pricing, any kind of tax, has on an economy. It can have an economic impact to the negative. And this is the line from your report the Conservatives point to. Once you factor in the rebate, but also the economic impacts, the majority of the households will see a negative impact as a result of the carbon tax. The rebuttal to that conclusion is that it doesn't tell the whole story. It doesn't look at other options and other impacts. What do you say in terms of people understanding the meaning of that analysis?
So the analysis looks at the world where we have a carbon tax versus the absence of a carbon tax, which is how we do economic analysis. So the impact of a carbon tax on the economy will have impacts on some sectors, the transportation sector, to take one example, or the oil and gas sector. Lower employment than would otherwise be the case, or lower profits than would otherwise be the case. So that translates into economic impacts on average for households, lower employment, lower profits, lower dividends for those who own stocks, etc. So these are the economic impacts.
Okay, and so this is where the analysis caused some confusion and drawn some criticism, because it's been that the analysis only compares the impact, as you said, of a carbon price versus nothing, and nothing isn't an option, right? It doesn't compare carbon pricing versus other options that other experts would say could be even more expensive. So how should people assess the political arguments we're seeing without a clear comparative analysis of the options?
So my mandate is to provide cost estimates of policy proposals by the government or policy measures that the government has introduced. My mandate does not include providing cost estimates of alternative scenarios or multiple options. So you're right that doing something else to reach international targets or Canada's commitment under the Paris Accord would also have costs. For example, if we were to introduce massive subsidies for new technologies to wean ourselves off of fossil fuels, that would obviously have costs. Introducing regulations, that also has costs. And these costs could be measured if we knew exactly what these alternatives are. But there's no clear policy proposal from the government as what would be the alternative to a carbon tax. So it's difficult to estimate the cost of something that has not been proposed yet.
Okay, but on that point, I've spoken to a lot of experts about this. We had Chris Reagan, who works at McGill University, who was part of the Ecofiscal Commission. He says you don't have to use carbon pricing to accomplish your climate goals, but he argues it's the least expensive and least intrusive option for the economy. You talked about subsidies. You talked about regulation. Would they be more or less expensive, more or less harmful to the economic picture than carbon pricing in your view?
Well, the consensus among economists is, generally speaking, a carbon tax is probably the least disruptive way to reduce emissions. That being said, we see that the government itself is not relying solely on a carbon tax for various reasons. So the government itself is introducing subsidies for clean fuel and regulations, clean fuel regulations. But it is true that a carbon tax is very often seen by many economists as the least disruptive and probably the most cost-effective way of reaching certain levels of carbon emissions.
Okay. So you can't assess this compared to another proposal because there is no other proposal to assess, right? You also don't factor in the cost of climate change. We've seen massive wildfires still burning from last year throughout the winter in British Columbia and in Alberta. You know, the extreme weather on the East Coast, flooding and storms. All of that has a massive economic impact as well, and a loss of productivity and cost to governments. The idea is to stop that from getting worse or more frequent. How do we assess that versus, you know, the cost of using carbon pricing to lower emissions?
That's a very difficult field to venture into because the number of unusual weather events that's occurring, we don't know which ones are due to climate change and which ones would have occurred anyways, or whether their extent would have been smaller or even worse, probably smaller. So especially in a short period of time. We've tried to estimate the impact of climate change between now and 2100, the year 2100, and we find that there is a cost to climate change. But for the next few years, between now and 2030, it's very difficult to determine precisely the cost of climate change. So it's an area that we ventured into, but it's not easy, and not that many institutions and organizations have established clear parameters under which to estimate the cost of climate change.
So we also have the criticism of relying solely on this analysis. I'm not saying the analysis was bad, but relying solely on this because of its limits. You don't see the economic benefits of the transition to a net zero economy. You're seeing a lot of capital flowing into projects like that. There is musing about the possibility of border adjustment tariffs for people that don't have carbon pricing. Mm-hmm. So that could be a cost that the Canadian economy incurs if they get rid of carbon pricing. So how do we assess that, right? Because people look at the price of a liter of gas is going to go up by 3.3 cents, and that is what's driving all of this. But these other future costs and opportunities, we don't have a rebuttal number on it so people can make a clear assessment. How should people view these things?
Well, the benefits of introducing new technologies or weaning ourselves off of fossil fuels will probably happen beyond 2030, which is the time horizon of our reports. So it's very unlikely that there'll be significant technological breakthroughs between now and 2030 sufficient to even partially offset the cost of a carbon tax, for example, or any measures to mitigate or reduce our carbon emissions. But it's quite possible that beyond 2030, once technologies become more mature, they'll be able to offset some of the costs that we'll have to incur to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. So that's why it's difficult to say whether the costs will be offset by the benefits over the longer term, but between now and 2030, it's clearly not going to happen. If you think of any technological measures mm-hmm. that governments rely on, it usually takes several years for them to become sufficiently mature to be right. widespread.
But really, I guess the horizon for that is more like 2050, right? When we're looking at the net zero target for the mid part of the century, we kind of have to think of that horizon, I suppose, right? So look, just as a final point, and you spelled out the limitations of your analysis and why. Your role as parliamentary budget officer, the lack of a clear alternative to assess it against. So when people look at this and say, this is a verdict that this policy isn't working and isn't worth it. What do you say?
I'm saying I'm providing unbiased, nonpartisan information, not pronouncements, not verdicts on policies. It's up to decision makers and Canadians to make up their own minds based on the information we provide them, so they can decide whether a carbon tax or other measures are the best way forward to reduce carbon emissions. We're not passing judgments mm-hmm. as to whether a policy is working or not, certainly not in that case. So in nonpartisan, unbiased information, but people can decide on their own.
Are you comfortable with the way it's being talked about? I mean, do you regret having done it with these limitations? Do you think you should broaden it in the future? What are your thoughts there?
Well, it's always good to have information, unbiased information out there for people to have enlightened debates. Whether we would do things differently, maybe with some respect, but I'm certainly happy that the reports are useful and are being used in parliamentary debates.
Right. Okay, but there are many other things we need to consider beyond this, right? Okay.
Totally.
Yves Giroux, Parliamentary Budget Officer, thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure.
The Liberal government is moving to make a major change to the military justice system, as the government intends to remove the military's jurisdiction to investigate and prosecute sexual offences committed in Canada. It's part of a suite of amendments introduced today by Defence Minister Bill Blair, and it would fulfil one of the key recommendations made by former Supreme Court Justice Louise Arbour. If the amendments pass, Criminal Code sexual offences committed in Canada will be investigated and prosecuted in the civilian justice system. Bill Blair is the Minister of National Defense. He joins me now from the foyer of the House of Commons. Minister Blair, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much, David. Thanks for having me.
The recommendations you're moving ahead with today, former Supreme Court Justice Louise Arbour, she recommended this in 2022, that all sexual offenses be investigated and prosecuted exclusively in the civilian justice system. What were the issues? Why did it take nearly 2 years to get to this point of legislative change?
Thank you, David. And even in Madam Justice Arbour's report that she did issue in 2022, she indicated that she recognized that these changes were going to take several years to implement. We've been working apace on all of her recommendations. I think we've made some very significant progress. But as Madam Justice Arbour acknowledged herself, it did require that we consult broadly with members of the Canadian Armed Forces, with particularly victims and survivors of sexual assault, and with a number of different advocacy groups and stakeholders. That work has continued. As a matter of fact, Lieutenant General Carignan from the Canadian Armed Forces indicates that they've consulted with over 16,000 members of the Canadian Armed Forces and stakeholders on this issue as well. We've been working very closely with the leadership of CAF and with the Judge Advocate General and with Solicitor Generals and Attorney Generals from across Canada to make sure that we were ready for this change. The introduction of legislation today is the culmination of a great deal of work that was taken on by my predecessor and her team, by the Department of National Defense and the Canadian Armed Forces, and we've had a lot of support from stakeholders and listened, I think. And one of the messages I really wanted to convey today, we've heard from those survivors. We're responding to their concerns, and I'm very pleased with the legislation we introduced today.
You mentioned in the list of people you spoke with were solicitors general and attorneys general at the provincial level, because one of the concerns is downloading this will stress out an already overstressed legal system at the provincial level across Canada. So what assurances, measures, and money are you going to provide for the provincial systems to be able to handle some of these cases?
Yeah, no, to be very clear, though, David, the civilian policing system in Canada and the civilian criminal justice system, we're not talking about tens of thousands of cases. In fact, we're talking about hundreds of cases. And in most jurisdictions across the country, the police of jurisdiction and the criminal justice systems are quite ably going to be able to deal with these cases and to prosecute them successfully. But we also recognize that some of our military bases are in smaller communities. And so we've been working with the Solicitor Generals and the Attorney Generals here in Ontario, for example. We've been working with the Sergeant, Mr. Kirchner. We've entered into a memorandum of understanding on how the federal government, the Canadian Armed Forces, will support civilian policing and civilian prosecutions, because we all have a responsibility. It's a shared responsibility between our government, the Canadian Armed Forces, and the civilian police and the civilian prosecutors to make sure that these cases are handled in an appropriate way,
right,
that victims receive the support, respect, and the services that they require. Our pursuit of justice for them, and as well to make sure that they have the victim support services and help that they need to recover from these experiences, is critically important. It's very much a shared responsibility, and I'm very confident. I come from the civilian policing world here in Canada, and I'm very confident they have the expertise, the resources, right, to do what is required.
This is also part of seeking justice for the victims here and the survivors here, but also cleaning up the cultural challenges inside the Canadian Armed Forces. You recently talked about the recruitment challenges and talked about the death spiral the forces were facing, with more people leaving than are coming in. What's your runway to reverse that, do you think? I know these things take time to get in, and that limits the ability to completely fix the culture, but what's the runway to turn things around for the CAF before it gets too low and it's too unfixable?
David, I can assure you that I, the leadership of the Canadian Armed Forces, and every member of the Canadian Armed Forces feels a strong sense of urgency. We want to make sure, we have a responsibility to make sure that every member of the Canadian Armed Forces, men and women, right across this country, have a supportive, safe, and respectful work environment to work in. One of the things that we've heard very clearly is when issues of sexual harassment and sexual assault do take place in the Canadian Armed Forces, that we needed to make some fundamental changes. Some of those changes are done through ministerial directives, changes in policy, and orders that come down from the top in the Canadian Armed Forces. And some of them required legislative change. Justice Arbour was very clear in her very strong advice to us that we needed to change the National Defense Act in order to facilitate the important changes in her recommendation 5 of ensuring that all of these cases would be investigated in the civilian policing system and prosecuted in the civilian justice system. And so with this legislation, we're institutionalizing that change. But changing a culture actually is a process, not an event. There has been an enormous amount of work done over the past several years within the Canadian Armed Forces to address that cultural change. I want to assure every man and woman who serves in the Canadian Armed Forces, and every man and woman in Canada who's contemplating a future service to their country in the Canadian Armed Forces, that we will do everything that's required to make sure that they have a safe, respectful, and supportive work environment. And at the same time, we know that we've got a great deal of work to do. We all share that sense of urgency to recruit the necessary skills and expertise and the terrific people that we need in the Canadian Armed Forces to come and work side by side with the people who have already chosen to serve. And we've got to do work to make sure that the work environment for all of them is not only safe and respectful, that we provide them with the best training, the best equipment, the best platforms to work on, and important missions that can really make the choice that they make to serve their country a meaningful and important one.
Okay, so that intention is very clear. I'm wondering, as Minister of Defense, if you can help us get some clarity on the implications of this motion that your party voted for, that the NDP brought into the House of Commons this week, that some are seeing as a full arms embargo and blocking of all military goods and technology going to Israel, while others, including your government, have suggested it doesn't really fundamentally change how you're operating, just no new military equipment requests will be honored and sent to Israel. What is your understanding as a cabinet minister, as a Minister of National Defense, of what your government has agreed to when it comes to military equipment of any kind going to Israel?
Yeah, and to be very clear, David, Canada has one of the most robust export permit systems for military equipment, and it's operated by our Global Affairs Department, but it is a very strong regime. Since January the 8th of this year, well before the resolution that came before Parliament, the motion that came before Parliament, since January 8th, under that existing regime, no new permits of military equipment have been yet approved by Global Affairs, and will not be approved until Global Affairs can be satisfied that each of those permits meets the rigorous standards and requirements of our existing export system. At the same time, all the permits that were issued prior to January 8th will continue to be, will proceed with those. They'll continue to be respected. I would characterize this as a continuation of existing government policy. We are still up. We haven't changed that very rigorous export regime, but we are making sure that all export permits that are approved meet the rigorous requirements of that system.
So it's business as usual, despite the drama and the language and the amendments and the fallout of that vote. What was the operating procedure the day before this vote is the operating procedure the days after
this vote. That's exactly right. And Global Affairs, as of January the 8th, has not issued any new permits for military equipment to Israel and will not, and they've made that clear well before this motion, that they would not be approving any of those of any new applications of for permit until we could be satisfied that each of those applications would meet the rigorous requirements of our existing export permit regime. But we've also acknowledged that there were a number of permits that were previously issued. They'll be respected, and we'll continue to proceed with that. And because, you know, I think there are, would be significant implications for failing to do so. But those permits that were previously issued were, in the opinion of GAC, fully compliant with that rigorous regime to which I have referred.
Right.
And any future one will be judged in the context of making sure that it meets the requirements within that regime.
Right. So, but if an order was on the books and it had met the export permit standard when it was placed,
yes,
even if it's an arms, military equipment, something the Israeli military can use, if it predates January 8th, it's allowed to leave the country and go to Israel.
If the permit was issued, it will remain in effect. But since January 8th, no new permits have been issued, and frankly, no new permits will be issued unless they satisfy the rigorous requirements of our export permit system.
Okay, as you know, the reaction to this, just as a final point, has been controversial and divisive because it was seen as much more than what you are laying out here with me now. We reached out to the government of Israel for their reaction. I spoke to a foreign policy advisor to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu named Ophir Falk. He's going to be on the show later in this program. He called this vote by the Canadian Parliament a badge of shame. And he compared the sentiment expressed in the Parliament this week to Canada's refusal to allow Jews into the country during the Holocaust. What's your reaction to, he's a Canadian Israeli, what's your reaction to those comments from an advisor to Prime Minister Netanyahu?
Respectfully, I believe he's wrong. That's a little hyperbolic. And in fact, the position of Canada has been well articulated well before that resolution. We were calling for a humanitarian ceasefire. We have said that Israel had a right to defend itself. We have said that Hamas is a terrorist organization. And in calling for a ceasefire, we've gone further and also said, and it's in that resolution, that Hamas, because they're a terrorist organization, needed to lay down their arms and return all hostages. And we have reiterated a long-held Canadian position that we support a negotiated two-state solution that would include security assurances for the state of Israel. And so, quite frankly, I would invite your commentator to go back and take a really good hard look at the full text of that motion and compare it to existing, long-held Canadian policy as it pertains to a two-state solution and statements that we have made previously calling for humanitarian ceasefire. We are, quite frankly, very concerned about the impact that the hostilities are having on innocent civilian lives. And while we absolutely believe that Israel has a right to defend itself, that cannot be at the cost of the loss of innocent civilian lives among the Palestinians. And so I think our position has been well articulated and clear. I think it's a principled position. And I would invite all Canadians to take a good hard look at what we've said and what we're doing.
Defense Minister Bill Blair, thank you for your time today, sir.
Thanks, David.
One of the top advisors for Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre is facing questions about her work in his office. The Globe and Mail is reporting that senior staff at Jenny Byrne's lobbying firm set up a second firm run out of the same office just a couple of days after Poilievre won the party leadership. And here's some reaction to that story from The Hill today.
We have a Conflict of Interest Act. We have a lobbying commissioner that sets very vigorous rules, and I expect everyone to follow those rules. I'm sure Mr. Polyev would be the first person to say that.
Clearly, that she is in charge of people who are lobbying. She's working for a lobbyist firm and trying to hide it from Canadians.
I think the same way you think when you wrote the article.
How did I think? I'm not sure.
It smells. It stinks to high heaven.
Okay, that's Minister Mark Miller there. He was talking to the Globe and Mail's Marika Walsh, who broke the story this morning and who joins us now. So, Marika, for people outside the Ottawa bubble who aren't regular appearers on this show, who is Jenny Byrne? Who else is involved? And what did you find out?
Thanks for having me, David. Jenny Byrne is really the most important operative in conservative circles behind Pierre Polyev. So she was central to his leadership campaign that led to his landslide victory. And she is a central player in the strategists and advisors that are behind him right now that has led him to having such a prominent role in public opinion polls with people talking about him as the next presumptive PM. So while she might not have a formally titled role for the public to see, she is central to the Conservatives' operations and takes part in their caucus meetings.
Okay, and she runs a company called Jenny Byrne and Associates, which is part of this story, and that split or was restructured to create another company called ForeCheck. Just walk us through what you found there about the corporate structure and the people who work for her and Jenny Byrne and Associates and their role in this other company.
Sorry, David, I think there might be an audio issue. I can't hear you. What I will tell you is that Jenny Byrne is the part owner, a minority owner of a provincial lobbying firm, and she is the CEO of that firm. It's named after her, and there are other people who are part of that firm. And what her senior staff on that firm did is that they created what's called ForeCheck Strategies shortly after Mr. Polyev's victory. And they say they created that to allow their staff, who also work at Jenny Byrne and Associates, to continue to lobby federally under ForeCheck. And they say that was done to ensure there was no conflict of interest. Now, the NDP are saying they think they do have questions about that. And that's why they've asked the lobbying commissioner today to look into it further.
Okay, Marika, you got me back now. You can hear me?
I do.
Okay, thanks for handling that audio drop like a pro. Look, Pierre Polyev's office told you Byrne is not paid by them. But if you had any more clarity from the Conservative Party about her role with them and whether she's being paid there, because presumably she's not working for free.
Mm-hmm. To be clear, Jenny Byrne, ForeCheck Strategies, Senior Vice President and President, which are also the Senior Vice President and President of Jenny Byrne and Associates, say there is no connection with Ms. Byrne. She has no role, receives no compensation for it, and has no role with their clients. Pierre Polyev's office declined to comment for me before the story came out, except to say that she is not paid for by the official leader of the opposition's office's budget. The Conservative Party, meantime, did not clarify whether she is or is not paid, and also did not clarify whether she would take a leave from her private work while she is playing an advisory role either now or in the future as we get closer to a campaign. For comparison, while the Liberals have gotten into a lot of trouble over the years over their own sort of lobbyist straddling political worlds, which happens a lot in Ottawa, mm-hmm. Katie Telford, who is sort of the comparator to Jenny Byrne in terms of stature and power within the Conservative Party, Katie Telford for the Liberals left the lobby firm that she was working at a year and a half before the 2015 election and then was formally named campaign director a few months after. So there's different ways that parties handle this. That same Liberal Party didn't apply the same standard to another senior person in that team, and that led to a lot of controversy for Trudeau in 2015.
Okay, that's a good reminder and a good point, because he did lose a member of his transition team. But I just want to make sure I'm completely understanding how the corporate structure works. There's Jenny Byrne and Associates, which is in a specific building at a specific address with specific staff, and they have mm-hmm. created ForeCheck Strategies in the same building, in the same address, with the same staff, but without her as part of the structure, and that's the division that they say allows this firm, despite the obvious links, to lobby federally without there being an issue. I'm understanding that right?
That's correct. And it's not that all staff at Jenny Byrne and Associates are also lifted at ForeCheck, but a good chunk of them are. And they do lobby federally, including with people within Mr. Polyev's office, as well as with the Conservative caucus. And to be clear, they did not clarify for me in advance of the story whether they had consulted the lobbying commissioner about this setup, but they said they had sought legal advice, and the advice they got was that it was within the rules and that this was allowed. Lawyers I've talked to since then have largely said that they believe this is also within the rules. However, Duff Conacher with Democracy Watch, who's known as somebody who is quite the stickler for rules and wanting stronger rules, said he believes that this would not stand up to the code of conduct.
Okay, Marika, great stuff. Thanks for joining us tonight. That's the Globe and Mail's. I almost said the CBC's. It's the Globe and Mail's, Marika Walsh. All right, the power panel has been listening in on this. James Moore is a former Conservative cabinet minister. Zane Velji is a former strategist for the Alberta NDP. And here with me in Ottawa, Carlene Varian is a former chief of staff to Liberal cabinet ministers. Susan Delacourt is a national columnist for the Toronto Star. Okay, Carlene, I want to show a statement first. The CBC got this statement from the president of both Jenny Byrne and Associates and Forecheck Strategies. And I just want to put this up on the screen. Forecheck Strategies is a separate entity with Jenny Byrne, which Jenny Byrne has no involvement in. She is not and has never been an employee, consultant, director, or shareholder. She does not, has not, and will not receive any compensation from Forecheck. The Liberals are pouncing on this, Carlene. They see this is a connection that's too close. They don't like the optics here. What's your sense of it?
I think the magic words that you sort of have to live and die by when you're looking at lobbying rules and whether lobbying activity is appropriate is sense of obligation. Is there a sense of obligation being created between a person who is on the receiving end of lobbying, of advocacy, and the person doing that work? So the question, I think, to ask in this situation, in terms of what the Globe and Mail has uncovered, is might you, if you're a member of Parliament who sits in the Conservative Party caucus, feel a sense of obligation to the business partner or associate of somebody who may have a role in deciding whether you get appointed to cabinet after the next election? So that's the question to ask. I can't answer that, but I think that that's probably one of the questions being raised by this. The timing is interesting, given the last couple of weeks where we've seen both the leader of the opposition and many of his lead spokespeople come out hitting against the idea of corporate lobbyists being advocates for public policy in Ottawa, and Pierre Poilievre himself talking about how if and when he's prime minister, those folks will have no role in deciding public policy. He'll only listen to Canadians. I think it's going to make that message a bit more difficult for him to land.
So, James, on this, you were part of the government that brought in all of these strict rules, right, about former staffers and lobbyists in the federal government and trying to clean up what was kind of a revolving door that may have existed under the old regime. What do you make of this arrangement that the people who work for Jenny Byrne at Jenny Byrne and Associates also run this company, run out of the same place, but they don't work for her there, so that means there's no issues. Does that fly?
Well, as everything has just been laid out, if that's all there is, and that's all there is, then it's a pretty weak argument against both Jenny Byrne or against Pierre Poilievre or against this entire dynamic. The rules have been followed. Nothing inappropriate has happened. A separate company was created in order to isolate Jenny Byrne away from this and from any perception or any reality of any kind of conflict of interest. This Liberal outrage at this, you know, there was no Liberal outrage when Don Guy or Mark Marison or David Hurley or any other long list of Liberals did this when they were working for sitting cabinet ministers and working for lobbying firms on the outside. And there was no outrage by the Globe and Mail or the CBC in castigating or chastising them. Jenny Byrne, I mean, like, I've known Jenny for over 20 years. She is a smart, ethical, understands the obligations of people within government and people who are trying to lobby or to have any kind of say with regard to public policy and their obligations to be clear and transparent about these things. And, you know, the establishment of a separate company is a sign that they understand the obligations to be transparent and to play by the rules. So, you know, the ethics commissioner apparently has looked at this or has given signal that this is okay. Lawyers, as you described, have looked at this, say that it's okay. It's clearly there's no clear thing going on here other than, frankly, Liberals trying to throw mud at somebody by association. And I think it's pretty ugly and pretty inappropriate.
So, James, how is this different then on an optical level from what the Conservatives did to David Johnston for his role in the Trudeau Foundation? You know what I mean? Like, these people are involved in a company that bears her name and now lobbying the federal government. And you say that's all clean, and maybe it is. But, you know, David Johnston got burned to the ground for being a volunteer mentor.
You will remember that I was critical of the treatment of David Johnston.
Oh, I wasn't putting that on you. I just want to make that clear.
Right. Well, I mean, it's slightly different because David Johnson was put in an impossible position as genuinely a family friend of Justin Trudeau to try to be a special rapporteur to a genuine family friend as some kind of effort to create kind of an ethical car wash. And it put David Johnson in an impossible spot. It was unfair for him and it was wrong to put him in that spot. So this you're comparing, I think, apples and hand grenades there.
I don't know, Zane, am I? I mean, the Conservatives said what they said about him. Lots of people said what they said about David Johnson because of, like, a name connection. Yeah. And here it's a corporate restructuring, but it's the same people who, you know, in one job work for her and another job don't. And this is what the questions are about.
I mean, the advice here is that all problems can be solved if you don't name a firm after yourself. Isn't that it?
Or a foundation, yeah.
Wrap it up and just call it. Listen, I'm largely with James on this. On the fact basis, listen, I've been a consultant for many years. I don't do any lobbying. But I've been with individuals that I've worked with over the years that have 3-4 business cards in their pocket. It's not because they're doing something nefarious, but they know that the brand that they need to sell in one jurisdiction is different than they need to in another. And that, you know, they're tailoring who they are and what services they can provide to the audiences that they talk about. So as long as the rules have been followed, I'm kind of with James on this. I still think this is a very fruitful attack by the Liberals because, you know, when we throw out the words, because they're trigger words here. Lobbyist is a trigger word. Loblaws was a trigger word. Jenny Byrne, the more she's known in political circles, is a trigger word. So this is helpful for the Liberals to keep going down here because there are true ethical questions that should be asked, not just of Jenny Byrne, but of those that volunteer their time to either a caucus or a political party, but are there for the upside. They're there to get the money on the back end for the lobby gigs, to have their name recognition, the proximity to the leader, the proximity to the platform, and so these questions are real. I'm not accusing Jenny Byrne of having engaged in any of what I've just said, but this line of attack is all about the vibes and the sniff test. And while James might be right, and I agree with him, that if the fact base is what it is, that there's probably nothing wrong here, the vibes of it just don't feel right. And politics these days is all about following the vibes, and the sniff tester just doesn't work for many people.
Susan, what's your thoughts on this and how tenable all of this is going to be in the months between now and an election?
Well, I agree that it doesn't pass the sniff test. And I think at the risk of disagreeing with my James Moore, a man I admire muchly, I do have to say, what would Jenny Byrne make of this? is probably the safest test. What would Jenny Byrne do with this? She would flame out over the idea of a lobbyist or somebody who owns a lobbying firm going to caucus meetings with the government in waiting and deciding whether MPs can run or not. I don't know any other lobbyist in Ottawa who goes to caucus meetings, frankly, or anybody who owns a lobbying firm who does, whether in government or opposition. So I think I think there's a lot to look into here. And I don't say that just because it's Jenny Byrne, who is a controversial figure. I think it's, I think I can't figure out how she's making her money also. Nobody is apparently she doesn't make her money from lobbying. Yeah. She's not paid by the Conservative leader. So I think there are some more questions to be asked here too. But this isn't just Liberals piling on to Jenny Byrne. This is being held to the same standards that you hold the government to. The standards for the government should be the same standards for a government in waiting, I think.
Yeah, well, technically and legally, I mean, they don't set the budget. They don't, no. Draft legislation. I mean, the government, is the government, right? Yeah. But like I take your point. But Carlene, like, help me understand, like, you've mm-hmm. worked in both worlds. Mm-hmm. I have never been in government. I have never been a lobbyist. How is it that a lobbyist is allowed to go in and out of a parliamentary caucus, work out of Parliament Hill in offices and stuff? Like, beyond her, I've seen Liberals with mm-hmm. lobbyists with access to Parliament Hill. I just don't know how that happens.
Well, and just to be clear, I'm also not a lobbyist, but I certainly know many of them. Yep. The first thing I would say is lobbying is a regulated profession, and there's mm-hmm. a very good reason for that. The vast majority of people who I know who do work as lobbyists in this town or in provincial capitals around the country are very aware of the rules that surround how they can govern themselves, particularly when they are people who also have very close relationships and influential relationships with people who have power or are perceived to probably very soon be in a position of having a great deal of power. And the reason that most lobbyists pay attention to these rules and take them seriously isn't just because it's the right thing to do. It's because, frankly, if you're running a company, you don't want your company's name in the headlines in this way. I can't imagine that this is very good for business. But the other thing that I would just say is, again, going back to the sort of the different standards and ways that parties can treat this, I was working on the Liberal campaign in 2015, and I remember very well when our campaign co-chair was discovered, Dan Gagne, to have been continuing to provide advice to some of his clients while he was, I think, the second or third probably most senior advisor to Justin Trudeau, who was the leader of the third party at the time. The second that information was revealed, he was out. He was gone. I haven't yet seen any argument for why that shouldn't be the same kind of appropriate course of action that Pierre Poilievre should take with respect to his senior advisor.
Well, James, your thoughts on that, but also to Susan's point earlier, as she was praising you while disagreeing with you, the question of what would Jenny Byrne do? It feels like this would be the sort of issue she might try to exploit if it was reversed.
Well, it would be an issue to exploit if there was some there. And the unfortunate thing is that there's no there. Like, I've known Jenny Byrne for 25 years. And I think, you know, Susan's point about, you know, this smells. Look, Jenny Byrne, you know, she is what we call in our party a movement conservative. She door knocks in the rain. You know, she works hard for the conservative movement, always have. There's no back end here, and there's no sort of, you know, oddness to this other than the fact that she tried to apparently play by the rules, set up a separate company that would be independent of her, that she has no stake in. She's not a director, receives no compensation, will receive no compensation in order to play by the rules that when she was a part of the Harper government, we helped to establish to clean up the corruption of mess after mess after mess of actual illegal lobbying and dirty play on behalf of the Liberals. So Jenny Byrne understands the rules, is playing by the rules, will continue to play by the rules, understands the rules because she was part of a government that brought in the rules. And so, you know, the idea that there's something here to pursue, I think, is grossly unfair. And by the way, you know, when we look for examples where people say, you know, why don't we get good people involved in politics? You know, when somebody gets their reputation dragged and attacked for having played by the rules very clearly and very transparently and talking to America when she did her piece in the Globe and Mail and explaining the dynamic of this, and then the Globe and Mail then going and talking to people who understand the lobbying rules and all of them say this all checks out, and then still to try to impugn her character, I think is really unfair and an example why, frankly, good people don't get involved in public life. And it's unfair to Jenny.
Oh, look, I'm not trying to impugn anything. This is a story in the Globe and Mail
but it's an unfair one, I think.
Okay. All right. Well, Zane, do you think it's unfair? What's your thoughts here?
I think our media orbit has changed over the last decade. Advisors, strategists, you know, these are great titles to have, but you now have the public exposure associated with it, which is good and bad, right? In some ways, I could say that if Jenny Byrne weathers this, whatever that might look like in the coming days or weeks, this is good for business. I mean, for those that know, it now underlines, and for those that didn't know, it now exposes that Jenny Byrne is the conservative whisperer. She's in caucus meetings. I didn't know that until this story broke out. That she has a direct line to Pierre Poilievre. And if you knew that, this now underlines it. So at the end of the day, I mean, I don't know if this is particularly bad for Jenny in that regard. As long as she's playing by the rules, this kind of solidifies her as the conservative that you want to talk to if you want to get stuff done in the nation's capital, all presuming that you know, the polls lead to the outcome we expect in a couple of years.
All right, Susan, quick final thoughts on this from you.
Isn't that what Pierre Poilievre was talking about, that him not liking, and when he's with the Vancouver Board of Trade like 2 weeks ago, that corporate lobbyists waving their influence around? I think that was something that he said he didn't like. So I agree, it's probably great for business, just not
well.
Great.
It would be, yeah. with respect, Susan, it would be true if that's what Jenny was doing. That's not what she's doing. That's not what this company is about. She's playing by the rules. That's the point, I think.
That's it for today. If you like this episode, please follow the pod and catch our next live show on CBC News Network. We're on weekdays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm David Cochrane. Thanks for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.